Great. Well, welcome to the Amadeus podcast. Today, it's me, Amelia Armour, joined by Herman Hauser, and we're going to have a chat about the emergence of the semiconductor industry. Now, Herman, I know you've been in the industry for a long time, but this even predates you, you know, back to the 1940s. If we think of sort of Bell Labs and the first transistor developed then, and then, you know, our investment in Graphcore and their latest chip, which has got 60 billion transistors on, you know, how in the last 60 years we've seen this emergence of this market. You know, when you look back to sort of Bell Labs and the use of transistors for amplification through to now Graphcore with this chip, which can be used for high-speed machine learning, you know, how do you see the sort of some of the most important developments along the way, and some of the excitements that you've seen?
Yes, well, although I wasn't there when the transistor was born, it took actually a long time for a single transistor to then mature to integrated circuits where they put more than one transistor on a chip. And then, of course, the big breakthrough, which I do remember very well, was Intel breakthroughs of putting enough transistors on a chip to produce the 4004, which was the world's first microprocessor, because that then was one of the most disruptive things that happened in computer science ever. That previously, if you wanted to build a computer, you had to build it out of valves or relays or single transistors, where you had all the functions that you had to put onto bespoke transistors. And with the microprocessors, you could change the program from a program that was implemented on silicon to a program that you could write for a microprocessor that could run lots and lots of programs, not just producing silicon for a single program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super exciting. If you think back to the sort of 1940s, it actually took quite a long time for a sort of a market to emerge for this new technology. You know, Texas Instruments, which were originally focused on technologies for helping people know where to dig for oil, then sort of moved into more military applications. And then Fairchild Semiconductors got these huge orders for the NASA program to help guide the rockets for the Apollo program. So suddenly there was this mass market that emerged. But it can actually take quite a long time, can't it, for this market to come through for new technologies. And so we sort of saw over 20, 30 years then this developing. And actually, when you think about how at Fairchild they developed the sort of masking technology so that you could really have multiple transistors on the chip and you didn't need all this integrated or this complicated wiring because it was all integrated. That seems super exciting and doesn't seem to really fundamentally change that technique of the masking since, you know, the Fairchild time in the 1950s.
Yes, that's right. The masks have stayed with us all through the many, many generations. It started off being masks that you could see with your naked eye. There were sort of millimeters. Then I remember living through this a very famous period of the 1 micron barrier, where all us physicists would swear to God Almighty that there is no way you could ever have a semiconductor below a micron, because there's the wavelength of light is half a micron. You can't produce, you can't define anything because of the laws of physics that's smaller than a micron with that sort of wavelength. And now we're down to 5 nanometers. So how did that happen? You know, we were stumped once we went below a micron, and now at 5 microns, at 5 nanometers, in our nanometers, a thousandth of a micron, we're actually 200 times better than we could never believe we could get past it, but we have.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then I think it's amazing to look at how the different players within the market have emerged. You think of sort of, you know, Texas Instruments back in the day, you know, doing the whole of the design and the fabrication and producing the chip, and then, you know, the calculators that people had, to now what we have today with Arm doing the design and selling to customers who are then designing those chips into their products, and then the chips are manufactured by TSMC and Taiwan, but TSMC themselves are then reliant on the production of lasers from European companies, and this specialization that has developed, which is completely global. You know, how have you seen that sort of evolve? And you know, what do you think about that today and the risks that are associated with that?
Yes, this is sometimes called the horizontalization of our industry. The industry started off, as you said, with Texas Instruments or IBM taking the sand off the beaches, making the ingots first, then producing the chips, putting the chips on circuit boards and then making the computers or the calculators in the case of Texas Instruments. And the big impact this had on us and the Cambridge environment was already with the BBC Micro, when at that time Britain had arguably the most advanced CMOS process with Plessy, and Ferranti invented FPGAs. They were called ULAs at the time, uncommitted logic arrays. So for the first time, a little startup like Acorn Computers could produce designs, give it to a chip manufacturer, and they would give back a working chip to you. And the interface was called the GDS2 tape. And the emergence of a GDS2 tape, a tape was a key event in separating different parts of the stack from each other. So the GDS2 tape allowed design companies to separate from fabrication companies. So before, you always had to design for a particular factory because they were all so different. After the GDS2 tape, you could make a design in the abstract and give it to a number of different factories, and they could produce it for you. And then, as you say, the higher layers appeared, and different parts of the stack were then covered by different types of companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super exciting. You think of Arm, you know, they've shipped more than 250 billion chips now. It's just amazing. But this huge acceleration, because it's really been an exponential growth in that shipment of chips. And you think about your car, you know, up to 3,000 chips in your car, and how ubiquitous the use of these chips are today, and how reliant we are on them for everyday life. You know, everything happens through my phone, pretty much. You know, without my phone, my sort of life grinds to a halt. And so we're terribly reliant on all these different parts of the supply chain. And, you know, in the UK, for example, you know, we don't have these great fabrication facilities that are elsewhere around the world. You know, how do you think at the UK or in Europe or the US even, like, not everyone has it all, you know, how do you think people manage that?
Well, it has become one of the iconic problems of our age. It's sometimes called technology sovereignty, and I'm just writing a book on it. And the conclusion that I've come to very quickly, especially in the semiconductor industry, is that there is no such thing as technology sovereignty because of the high degree of interconnectivity, the sort of hyperconnectivity that we have in our world now. A good example of that is that before a chip actually hits the circuit board on an iPhone production line, that chip traverses 40 national boundaries. So these chips go backwards and forwards so many times throughout the stack that there is no country, not even the US or China, that can have it all.
Mm. That's super exciting, and it gives us opportunity for what we can do in the UK and in Europe. But obviously, there's risk if we lose access to some of these parts of the market because we're so reliant on it. In a way, that it's good that no one has capacity to do it all of themselves, because at least we're all reliant on each other, which will hopefully lead to positive discussions and engagement.
Well, it's not quite as rosy as that, because although we're reliant on each other, there are some choke points where we are becoming dependent on the single supplier in the single country. A good example, of course, is the duopoly of EDA tools in the United States. Nobody can design a sophisticated chip mm-hmm. without using the design software from Cadence, either Cadence or Synopsys. And Trump has actually used that to force European companies to do their bidding. Now, fortunately, Europe also has a company called ASML in Holland that has a monopoly on extreme UV tools to produce chips below 5 nanometers. And there's nobody else in the world that can do that. So people at TSMC and Samsung, which are actually the only two factories that can produce chips below 5 nanometers, have to use the ASML tools. And so it, of course, does Intel and AMD and all the other countries in the world. And then with ARM, of course, we have a microprocessor design, which now has become the standard in mobile phones and with IoT. So Britain also has a very strong position with ARM.
Yeah, that's great. And I was wondering, because we're living through this exciting time of the this new computing architecture and quantum processors being developed, and looking back to see how the semiconductor-based chips were developed and the market grew, I find it amazing to be part of this time when we see the quantum processor emerging. And, you know, we see companies that again started offering full stack solutions, and now this emergent in the market of these different layers of the stack. Obviously, with the semiconductor chips, it took quite a long time, you know, from the 1940s, you know, to the 50s, 60s to really get production up to into the volumes. How do you see the quantum market sort of mapping onto that? Do you think it will be much faster to iterate and have a working quantum processor that's really adding something of value to over and above a CPU or a GPU?
Yes, I do. I think it's you know, for somebody who's lived through the emergence of the classical computing stack, it's very exciting to see. It's a sort of déjà vu. In many ways, we're again producing really a very different computing stack based on quantum technology. Some of the implementations of quantum computers rely heavily on the enormous experience that we have with silicon. So some are silicon-based, but not all of them are silicon-based. So there are some new approaches, especially using photonics, that are completely different. And what is especially exciting is that there are really five completely different way of producing qubits. And we did have that with in the classical computer stack as well. When we started off with it, it wasn't clear whether it was germanium or silicon or gallium arsenide that were going to be the key transistors that everybody would use. And it was silicon that finally won out. In quantum computing, we've got superconducting qubits at the moment, which have the nose out front, followed by ion traps, but closely followed by photonic solutions and electron spins in silicon, which is particularly exciting, and also combinations between electron spins in silicon and photons, like in our photonic company, which is the only a company that actually mixes electrons and photons, which we're particularly excited about, because there's an old saying in our industry that if you want to compute, use electrons, and if you want to communicate, use photons, and photonic does both.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And it's a really exciting time, because obviously we've seen the production of these chips like graph cores with huge numbers transistors, but there is a limit to some of the calculations that can be done on a classical computer. And so the quantum processor will really take our ability to simulate, for example, into much, much, much higher levels, which is super exciting.
Yes. In fact, it's exponential. So it's not just a little bit more. It's potentially a fantastic factor. So it's these quantum computers have the potential of solving problems that a classical computer will never be able to solve. And by never, I mean sort of hundreds of thousands of years. So it's just completely unrealistic. And quantum computers, because of two effects that just don't exist in classical computers, that's superposition and entanglement. They have this intrinsic parallel processing capability of entangled qubits, where they explore a very large space all at the same time. And that's what gives quantum computers their power.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, compared to your transistor, which is either zero or one, you know, the ability to do the superposition.
Yes, that's really at the very bottom. The reason for the power of quantum computers is the qubit. And the qubit, in analogy to a normal bit, can be in a state that's 10% zero, 90% one, 50% zero, 50% one, or 67% zero, and 24% one. So you see that a qubit actually can hold a lot more information than just a zero and a one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that superposition principle, as it's called, is one of the reasons why it's so powerful.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see the emergence of new materials? Because obviously, you know, silicon has been, you know, the dominant used material since the, you know, the 1940s. Now we see other materials that have come to the fore that can give sort of particular specialist applications. And, you know, one of our investments is in Paragraph, which is a company that is using single layer carbon. And this ability to have a free electron shooting all around the top of the 2D material of this carbon sort of single structure gives us this amazing conductivity, which can then be used. How have you seen other materials sort of emerge over time?
Well, we've been through a number of different material sets. Gallium arsenide, people were very excited about gallium arsenide for a long time. They thought gallium arsenide would take over from silicon because it can actually produce transistors that switch faster than silicon. But we've never managed to get the same sort of density of gallium arsenide transistors on a single chip as we do with silicon. So gallium arsenide really never made it. Except for, you know, the radio industry where you need these very high frequencies. But what you've mentioned, which is graphene, is a new 2D material with just the most extraordinary properties, like the very high conductivity that you just mentioned, but also very high thermal conductivity and incredible strength. It's much stronger than steel. So it has all these really exciting properties, and being involved in a company called Paragraph that we've invested in that actually is the leading producer of these graphene sheets, because it turns out that it is extremely hard to produce it. The Nobel laureates in Manchester had a very simple way of just using Scotch tape to peel off a single layer from a graphite block. And that's just not good enough for mass production. So we had to find a new way of doing it.
Yeah, Paragraph have done very well there using standard semiconductor manufacturing equipment to produce graphene at scale, so that, you know, companies can now use it, because it's had these amazing properties which you've described, which have been known for 20 years. But the inability to scale up this production has been such a barrier to its use. And, you know, that's where Paragraph are really excelling. And I suppose that, you know, Paragraph is a UK company which has come from the University of Cambridge, and it's exciting that the materials that are being developed here and the other technologies that we have in the UK. Where do you see in that supply chain that we talked about, you know, the real advantages of the UK in the semiconductor market?
Well, with Paragraph, we do have a very unusual company in Britain that produces the best and largest graphene sheets in the world at the moment. So this is an unusual situation for Britain to be in, because normally we rely on the basic ingots and the production of silicon from lots of other countries around the world. but you talked earlier on about the emerging stack in quantum computing. There again, we have different layers appearing above the materials. And one of the main differences between the classical computer stack and the quantum computer stack is actually the error correction layer.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got error correction in all our computers and all our laptops and all our smartphones. But looking back at it's almost trivial compared with the error correction that is needed for these qubits, because these qubits are so fickle. You really have got to be very clever about the codes that you use in order to correct this. And there we've got a company called Riverlane that is the leading company in the world doing the error correction layer for quantum computers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really exciting. And then We should mention Exmos as well as a company that has developed a chip that works really well for machine learning at the edge, because we now see so many more connected devices that it's not all the processing is done in the cloud or in the data center. You need to have fast processing done at the edge of the network. And Exmos is a Bristol company from David May's lab, and that's really found its market now in terms of the development of the IoT devices. And you've obviously been involved with that company for a long time and seen it emerge. And you must have been very excited when you first saw the technology there, because it was so breakthrough.
Yes. Yes, I remember David coming to me saying he wants to do another processor. And I said, David, watch my lips. The world does not need another processor. And he said, but mine is different. And it was. And at that time, we didn't expect that AI was going to be one of the main applications, as it turned out. But it is a perfect fit for doing AI on the edge. And if you look at computer systems in a holistic way rather than just a single computer chip, then, as you say, more and more of the processing will have to be done on the edge, as it is indeed with biological systems. So if you look, for example, at our eye, the amount of information that hits the retina is many thousands of times larger than the information that then gets passed on from the retina through the optical nerve to the brain. So a lot of the clever processing of the image on the retina is already done by the retina itself. So there's a lot of edge processing there. Same thing with the ear, with the cochlea. The cochlea does a wonderful logarithmic translation of frequencies before it ever passes it on to the brain. And this sort of processing, signal processing, and then the reduction of the information that you pass on to the main computer is one of the key problems that that we need to solve now. And Exmos has a very good solution for it.
That's brilliant. Well, Herman, it's been a delight speaking to you today. A super important field, you know, one that we've invested in over many years, and I'm sure we will continue to do so as time continues. So thanks very much. It's been great to talk to you.
Well, thank you.